Does anybody want to win the Pac-12 besides Oregon and Utah? It doesn't seem like it. Everybody seems to be messing it up for themselves. We're going to recap and we're going to grade all the teams in the conference. And also, we have a new champion in the conference. We have a new worst team in the conference. It is no longer the team that it's been for the last seemingly decade. We have a new cellar dweller team. And one defensive coordinator resigns, and maybe there should be two. And of course, the Pac-12 power rankings. I'm George Reister with Ralph Amsden, and this is the Pac-12 Apostles. Ralph, after week six in the Pac-12, there were some interesting games, but it seems like nobody wants to win the conference right now besides Oregon and Utah. Everybody else is screwing it up for themselves. But there is a side note. Arizona, who we thought Kevin Sumlin was going to be on the hot seat, they are playing extremely well as well.
Yeah, it's like ever since people were like, let's fire Marcel Yates. And I think we even brought it up on the podcast that his time could be short in Arizona. They've all sort of rallied around him and played some better defense. Not great defense. They still had a pretty rough go against Colorado, but they did enough. And so the defense is not super talented, not super deep, but they're playing inspired right now. And offensively, they've got some good things going for them, even though they've got an unhealthy quarterback. And it's sort of helped that they've got, you know, UCLA and Colorado in back-to-back weeks who haven't really been able to stop anyone either. And so, yeah, a part of it's just they're in a really, really advantageous part of their schedule. It's going to get tougher from here.
I look at this and I'm saying, when I watch Saturdays, it seems like there's so much consistency in other conferences that you know who's going to win. If you have a ranked team playing a non-ranked team, the ranked team just consistently wins. And the only thing more chaotic than the Pac-12 schedule every week and who's going to win is Pac-12 After Dark, because you know weirdo stuff is going to happen.
And you said it. I mean, you said that was going to go down, and I didn't believe it. And Stanford went out and put Washington to sleep. They almost put me to sleep. Three different times I had to pinch myself to stay awake for that entire fourth quarter. And I'm somebody who goes to bed at like 1, 2 in the morning. And so this was, I mean, they were like out there snake charming. Just, I mean, I could not believe how Washington just fell right into Stanford's trap the way they did.
How much do you think is, you know, related to the Pac-12 schedule? You know, playing on Thursdays, playing at 9 a.m., playing at 12:30. I mean, there's so much variance in start times and days of the week. Do you think that creates some of the chaos?
Consistency breeds consistency. I believe that wholeheartedly. I think you've seen the NFL move to a schedule where they're moving people around even more. And I think that you've started to see the product reflect what the NFL is doing. Everybody knows that 4 out of every 5 Thursday night games is going to be a giant mess. The NFL has always had parity, but you know, the play on the field usually hasn't been as crazy from week to week. And now that that's happening, it just kind of reminds me of what goes on in the Pac-12, because you never really know what somebody's going to be able to do from week to week, because stylistically things are so strange. The travel is pretty wild. You know, people talk about how difficult it is for a West Coast team to go east, but that's the same amount of distance that Arizona State travels when, if they're going to go to Seattle, or the same amount of distance that USC travels if they're going to go to Pullman. So, I mean, Colorado and Utah, everybody thinks that they're right next to each other, but those two schools are over 1,000 miles from each other. The travel's hard, the scheduling's hard, the different styles are hard. Everything about stuff in the Pac-12 sort of feeds into, you know, you never really know what's going to happen from week to week. It's part of the appeal of the conference, and it's ultimately the most frustrating thing about it as well.
You literally cannot count on anybody for anything.
No.
Because everybody knows that, like, so originally you had Oregon and Washington kind of being picked around, Oregon, Washington, and Utah really being picked a lot around the conference, potential playoff, and all of that. And then Cal sneaks up, which I thought they could, and they play well. And then Cal gets all the way, I think they were ranked 15th. before they went and lost to Arizona State. And you're just sitting there, and Chase Garbers gets hurt. So you're sitting there like, come on, man. Like, we can't count on you for anything, because Cal is nothing offensively without Chase Garbers. It completely changes who they are. They are a team that went from potentially contending for the Pac-12 North Championship, being a legit contender. And we've seen that with how they've been able to strangle people defensively. They put Oregon in a headlock for three quarters, basically. They obviously beat Washington back-to-back years. This is a time where I'm sitting there like, this ain't good, brother. Like, the and then you got Washington turn around and loses to Stanford. And now that, so the Cal-Oregon game lost so much of its luster, because if Cal were undefeated, it could have been a game day game. And then the Oregon-Washington game could have been another game day event. But now neither one of those teams is ranked. And it's so frustrating. Like, you should be able to count on your best teams to win games. That way you have big games in the conference.
Yeah. I mean, look, when you see Cal on the schedule, it's still going to be like walking over hot coals, right? Like, there's nothing fun about having to play against this defense. Oregon learned that. Everyone's going to have to learn that. But, you know, you said that they're not able to do much without Chase Garbers. They weren't doing much with him. It was always going to be an uphill battle for Cal. Everything was going to have to go right. And the only thing that you can really expect in the Pac-12 is that you're going to have some injuries. We know that now, because almost everybody's on their backup quarterback at this point, if not third string. I mean, we got to see Stanford play a third string quarterback. We got to see a third string quarterback start at USC. We got to see a freshman start for U of A. It's been an absolute mess all over the place. And so, I mean, you know, this conference is not, I don't know what else to say. But I look at Cal right now, and I know that they're probably going to get a couple of wins down the stretch just by playing the way that they play. The defense is going to go out and do the job. They're that good.
Yeah, but the problem with it is that Cal, when they're not ranked, they don't get that respect nationally for a win against them. So it looks like they are just another team. When their defense, I mean, I'm not going to. So I heard from two coaches that in the Pac-12, they said Cal has a national championship caliber defense. They just do not have an offense to match.
And that happens, right? That happens. I mean, sometimes that can still, you know, that can still put you over the top. I mean, Arizona State had that back in 2009. If you go and look at what they were putting on the field, and offensively, they did absolutely nothing. The offensive line was too young. They couldn't run the ball. And it reminds me of this year's Cal team. Like, it was, playing Arizona State back in 2009 was a pain in the ass, but it was a win. So, I mean, sometimes it just works out like that. Now, if they can capitalize on it, they'll be in a really good place, because they've been recruiting really well. They've got some offensive help that is on the way. I think that as long as the coaches don't get a little bit antsy and start jumping ship and capitalizing on all of the goodwill that they've built up so far, and have a little bit of patience, they could still, you know, they could still be on an upward trajectory. I believe that.
So the question is this, Ralph, is who at this point in time, because you have, I'm going to Lee, I'm going to let you go first, because I have been way wrong on the picks as of the last couple of weeks. I have been struggling. So I picked Colorado. They lost. Picked Oregon. They won. Picked UCLA. They lost. Did I pick Stanford?
Okay, so I got to go back and listen, because you kept saying over and over and over again that, like, something crazy is going to happen, and you were leaning Stanford, but I don't remember if you locked that in or not. Because I was thinking about that leading into the show. Is I was like, he didn't go through with it, did he? I felt like you did, maybe.
No. I even tweeted it out. Now that I think about it, I tweeted out.
Okay,
I
said, you were.
I said that Stanford is going to bounce back. That they're going to make this extremely difficult for Washington. and that, but Washington will eventually pull it out barely on like a field goal or something. And
yeah, no, you were leaning Stanford pretty hard on the podcast.
It was so correctly. I mean, it felt so obvious to me, but Stanford was playing so poorly. So who do you think at this point in time, looking at the Pac-12 standings, who do you believe will ultimately end up winning the South?
I don't know, BYU or somebody. Nobody in the South. I think Utah's got a path to it, but they can't lose. Like, they already lost to USC. Arizona State is an absolute thorn in their side almost always. The more and more I watch Steven Montez go to work, the more and more dangerous they look.
They just don't play any defense.
No, they do not. They do not. I think that Utah's probably in prime position, unless, as Slovis, you know, gets this week off and he's healthy and he looks more like he did in his first appearance, then I might give the edge to USC. USC was my pick at 8-4 to win the South heading in, and they've got that tiebreaker over Utah at this point. So I think that Utah's probably the better team at this point in time, but USC's got that advantage. And if USC can win the games that it's pretty obvious that they are far more talented than their opposition, especially with, with UCLA and Colorado, then win a couple that maybe people don't think that they have the ability to, then maybe they'll do it. But for me right now, it's a toss up between Utah and USC.
I think that whoever wins the South could have three conference losses, which is crazy. But now we can finish up with our Pac-12 power rankings, Ralph. Pac-12 power rankings, which obviously have gotten, well, I would say the Pac-12 power rankings have gotten crazy this week, only because as the season moves on, it's so much more difficult to assess who is the best team in the conference. Because not the best. I would say four through 11 are difficult picks at this point in time because so many of those teams have beat each other. So what are your teams right now, Ralph?
Cool. So I've moved past the point of feeling bad about my picks, and it's just if somebody wants to argue with me, I'll just say, you know what? Okay, like maybe you're right. But this week broke me for sure. UCLA at number 12. I feel good-ish about that. Oregon State at number 11.
They literally lost to the team. They have one win, and they lost to the team that was in 12. So, yes, that's an easy one.
And a big congratulations to Oregon State at number 11. This is an accomplishment. You should celebrate. Shout-out to my guy Colby Taylor out there. I know you're not listening to this, but I'm glad to see Oregon State out of the cellar. Washington State at number 10. Cal coming in at number 9, and I do not feel good about that, but I'm just sort of projecting into the future. Colorado at 8, and we got University of Arizona at 4-1 at number 7.
Wow. Wow. How did you put them at number 7?
Well, you've seen the schedule that they have coming up. I'm just letting them know where they're going to end up.
See, you put people where they're going to end up. I put people where they are and where they deserve to be, where I feel like they deserve to be at this point in time. I think that there are so many times that teams, you know, that they are, that people try to project out, and I just base it on three criteria: schedule play, dominance, and quality wins. And this was a tough one for me. I got UCLA at number 12, which was an obvious, easy choice. Worst defense in America, probably. And definitely the worst defense in the Pac-12. I like Chip Kelly. Don't love how this team's playing, especially without Dorian Thompson-Robinson. Number 11, the Oregon State Beavers. They are out of the cellar. It is to be appreciated and congratulated. High five, Beavers. Number 10, I have the boys from the Palouse. the Washington State Cougars. At number 9, I have the Colorado Buffaloes, who fell from number 4 to number 5. I'm sorry, from number 4 to number 9. At number 8, I have the Stanford Cardinal, because they got a big win. And when you get big wins, you get big moves. They beat Washington, which everybody respects in the conference, even though they might not respect them quite as much this week. And then at number 7, I got Cal. Cal is just not the same team without Garbers. They are tremendous on defense. They will give you a headache. But the problem is, if you score 20 points, you're probably going to win. If you can find a way to get 20 points, you're probably going to win. And they have held, I think, their last 13 or something opponents to under 25 points, which is pretty doggone incredible. Try that, UCLA. So who are your top 6, Ralph?
My top 6, I'm going with, and this we'll call this a warning shot, but I got Washington at number 6. And above them, for what happened at number 5, I have Stanford. That just makes sense to me at this point for some reason. USC at number 4.
You know Stanford lost badly, right?
Yeah.
You know they lost badly to UCF. They lost badly to they lost pretty badly to Oregon. And then they got crushed by USC. You do know that, right?
I do know that. I'm looking at some of the teams that are coming up on their schedule, and I'm not sure that those teams know how to get out of quicksand either. So they're currently my number 5. Number 4, I've got USC. They get that off-week boost just from other people looking bad. It's always nice for USC to have that week off where they're not really making any mistakes. For some reason, every bye week for USC always feels like a win. Number 3, I've got Arizona State. And it feels like they're overrated by me in this case, but I've been thinking about this, and I have them at number 3 because they remind me of there was a guy who fought in the UFC for a few years, and his name was Matt Brown. And I think he got into the UFC through their reality show, and at the time he was like 8-6 in his career. And usually in the UFC, if you lose a couple of fights in a row, you get cut from the production, right? Because they just want the best of the best. This dude fought in the UFC for several years, for like 8-9 years, and he went 13-10. And he lost a whole bunch, but every single time he fought, it was like bloody, right? And that's what people liked, is that it was even if he got beat, it was a problem for the other team. And Arizona State, to me, more and more, they are the Matt Brown of this conference. It does not matter that they are worse than another team. It does not matter if they're better than another team. They're going to go in and they're going to find a way to make it an absolute slugfest. And both teams at the end of the game are going to be covered in blood, and you say good fight and you move on. And so that's kind of the exciting thing about Arizona State football right now. But talent-wise, I still don't think they're very good. And so it's crazy to me to have them as high as number 3, because there exists a universe in which somehow Arizona State ends up 11-1. It could happen. And at the same time, yeah, they could lose a bunch too. And you never really know what you're going to get with them. You just know it's going to be fun to watch. I got Utah at number 2. They get that bye week boost as well, but they are very, very strong in some areas where you need to be strong to be competitive. And then number 1 at this point is Oregon, just sort of by default. They're the most talented team, and they're winning the games that they should be winning. So far, everyone else in the Pac-12 has managed to, I think, lose a game as a favorite. And Oregon has not pulled that off yet. And for that reason, they come in at number 1.
For me, at number 6, I got the USC Trojans. I'm still unsure about this team at quarterback. They have been up and down. They lost to BYU. They lost to who did they just lose to? They lost to BYU, and they lost to.
You're talking about USC?
Oh my God, I'm so confused. They UCLA lost to BYU, and they lost to Washington. Jeez Louise. They lost to Washington.
Oh, I was getting confused because I thought you kept mixing up UCLA and USC, and so I couldn't follow. I was like, wait, is he talking UCLA didn't lose to BYU? I mean, they will if they're on the schedule.
So,
but they haven't yet.
I got USC at 6. I got Washington at 5. I had to put them in front of UCLA because they just beat USC a couple weeks ago. Wait, did I say UCLA again?
Oh, you man. Did it again. I'm so confused right now.
So, okay, 6 USC, 5 the Washington Huskies, 4 the Arizona Wildcats. This doesn't feel good at all. I'm going to tell you, 4 doesn't feel good. Arizona State at 3. I agree with everything you said about them. It doesn't feel good, just like Colorado didn't feel good at number 4 last week. It didn't feel good. And so if it doesn't feel good, you know what's coming next. Number 2, it's obvious. You got Utah, who's playing well, and Tyler Huntley is trying to shut me up. I get it. I understand. I will not doubt you again until it's time to doubt you again. And then you got Oregon at number 1. This is clear. They're the best team in the conference, and hopefully they can finish the season 11-1 and play against an 11-1 Utah in the Pac-12 championship, and you can have a top 10 showdown in the Pac-12 championship, and maybe the winner sneaks into the Pac-12 playoff. I'm the college football playoff. That is my hope, Ralph. The conference is just set up for absolute madness, but I think in the South, I think USC. I would go with either USC, Arizona, or Arizona State. But I'm going to go with USC with a second, with like a side. I think that USC, I'll give them a 75% chance to win the South. I'll give Arizona State a 75. I'll give Arizona State a 20% chance to win the South, and I'll give everybody else except for UCLA a 5% chance.
Did you see the Kyle Bonagura, the ESPN.com reporter? Did you see his tweet about the algorithm he used to determine the most likely final Pac-12 standings?
Oh yeah,
I've been laughing about that all day.
Everybody at either 5-4 or 4-5. Every single team was. And it's mathematically possible, and it's not likely only because I would find it very hard pressed to see Utah or Oregon losing 4 conference games.
Yes,
I think that's a bit far fetched, but he's not that far off.
It made me laugh when you were talking just now. I was just thinking about that tweet. And the fact that a couple of the people and it always works out this way, but a couple of the people in his replies were like, "You're dumb," and I think they thought that he was serious. But oh man, I looked at that and I was like, "Yeah, why not? Why would this not be a feasible thing this year?"
Ralph, and I want to let everybody know, you guys, this is the Pac-12 Apostles, a podcast for the Pac-12. This is about us, the conference that we care about. So you guys make sure that you guys share the feed, tell a friend about Pac-12 Apostles, because this is for us. We are underrepresented, and people always want to hate on the Pac-12, say we're, you know, and we are going to have a voice. We are going to be present all the time. But I say that to say this. We are about accountability on the Pac-12 Apostles. We hold Larry Scott accountable. We hold the teams accountable, coaches, all of that. And I have to be held accountable at this point in time, Ralph.
Okay.
I mocked you. I laughed at you. I called you a fool. I called you crazy for saying that UCLA was going to be so bad, saying that they were going to go 1-11. And now I must apologize, because even if they do win 2 games, your pick, your prediction was not that outrageous. And you were clearly spot on. Even if they win a second game, this team is putrid. It is tough to watch. I was in the stands yesterday. I was like, why?
I tell you what, it's never fun to be right about someone else's struggle. Unless you're getting paid, and I'm not getting paid to be right about, you know, this isn't like the guys from The Big Short who made a bunch of money realizing that the collapse of the economy was coming. I didn't feel like it was outrageous. I looked at this team, and now there's a caveat here, right? I said that if they stick with Chip Kelly, this is breaking a bone and resetting that bone. They are going to start to look more like a Chip Kelly team as long as you have the patience to get through what is going to be some very, very ugly football. And they're in the ugly part of it. And a lot of people don't have the stomach for that, especially in today's day and age. Because if something looks really, really bad, you start to panic and think, you know, it's unsalvageable. It's that moment when you're underwater and you're holding your breath and it hits you. And then it's all instinct, like get to the surface, get to the surface. And that might ultimately be where, you know, UCLA boosters and UCLA fans end up as this season progresses. But I don't think that they should, because I don't, unless they're going to go young, and we'll talk about that, I don't think that there's a better option for them out there right now. And if you're going to hire Chip Kelly, you have to commit to his process. Otherwise, it's not Chip Kelly that looks bad. He has like two buyouts that he can just fall back on. And if they want to give him a third one, then, you know, Chip Kelly can do that Breaking Bad thing where the dude just goes backwards onto the big pile of cash. Like, except Chip Kelly can have, like, twin mattresses. Like, he can have multiple beds around the room. He has so much money. He's not going to lose. That team might be losing on the field, but Chip Kelly's in a position in his life right now where there is no losing. So if you're going to hire him, you got to stick this process out, or you're the one that's going to suffer. You're the one that's going to end up looking bad. And so I would just exercise patience. If you were going to bring him in the way that he recruits and the way that he does things, you have to have a 3 or 4 year commitment to before you even open up the idea of, you know, are we going to make a change? And I always felt like going into year two is when it was going to look the absolute worst, and it looks really bad.
Oh, well, see, yes. It's weird because they look atrocious on defense. I have not seen a less physical, a more undisciplined, bad scheme having team in a long time. But offensively, they look better. I mean, even with the backup quarterback, Burton, he was pretty good. Put up 31 points. Problem is, you gave up 48. I mean, it is just like you can't win with this type of defense. You just can't. And that brings us to UCLA's defensive coordinator, Jerry Azzanaro. And the reason why he's brought up, why we bring up coaches, is because he is the leader of it. And you had this same week, Tracy Clays, the defensive coordinator at Washington State, resigned. Some people speculated that it was for health reasons, but it wasn't. He put out a tweet, said, "Thank you, Coach Leach, for the opportunity. I didn't resign for health or personal reasons. The defense has struggled, and I am responsible. We couldn't agree on solutions, so the speed D is better with new leadership. I love the players and staff."
Can I jump in and talk about this tweet real quick?
Go Cougs.
This is my favorite coaching thing I've ever seen. This is the best. And let me tell you why. Number one, gratitude. Gratitude is the most important thing in life, hands down. And you can weigh in on whether or not you believe there's sincerity in this, but I think that you should always lead with gratitude. He thanks Coach Leach. Love that. It was an opportunity that was given to him by Coach Leach. He did what he could with it. Be grateful. He says, "I didn't resign for health or personal reasons." So he's honest. I love the honesty. "The defense has struggled and I am responsible." There is nothing better in this world than taking ownership over issues. Some people maybe do it to call attention to themselves, to garner sympathy. I don't believe that's the case in this point, the point in this case. I think that he is saying that this is on me. I'm responsible for this defense. They are underperforming, and so ultimately, at the end of the day, that belongs to me. That's my bag to hold. We couldn't agree on solutions, so the speed D is better with new leadership. So even he's willing to go out of his way and say, like, hey, everybody has to be on the same page, and it's better for the players if they're on the same page. And then he finishes up by saying, I love the players and staff, and then encouraging them, saying that they'll finish strong and go Cougs. Like, you could not go out the door any more graceful than he did. And you know that this wasn't a graceful process. In order for something like this to come to a head, there probably had to be some really, really tough moments. Some really tough moments. He didn't want to not work there, right? He wanted to finish the season off. He's making a really good salary, but he steps away from that position.
Yeah, but is this a stupid move? Okay. Though? Is the question. And the only reason why I asked that is because you talked about the honorable thing. Okay, I get it. But my question has to do with his buyout,
okay,
whether this was a mutual decision and he's getting some sort of buyout to a leave, because who leaves their couple $100,000 a year job or few $100,000 because he's a defensive coordinator for just because you feel like you weren't doing a good enough job? Because coaches' contracts are guaranteed or at least some portion of them, the majority of them are fully guaranteed. Or guaranteed to a portion, you know, 50%, 75%, depending on the year and all that stuff. But they're mostly guaranteed. So is this a wise move? Or do you think that
Pride's a weird thing, okay? Did I see you tweeting earlier today about Stephon Diggs eating $200,000 just to not show up to practice?
Mm-hmm.
So pride is a really, really strange thing. Tracy Clay's got a raise going into this season. It wasn't a big raise, but it was, you know, he got an extra $25,000 thrown his way. I don't know if it's smart for him. He was, but sometimes your pride steps in, honestly, with full conviction. But it would be better for the team if you take one for the team. I think that people will look at what he did last year and this year for Washington State and realize that the only way that an air raid is ever able to be competitive is if the defense can stop somebody to put the offense on the field at some point, you know? And so I think that he's probably a guy who will be in demand, especially to leave the way he did, to say, you know, this team is still going to be good. I was responsible for the mistakes. And you know, I think that will send a signal to other people who are looking to hire somebody that, like, hey, this is a guy that we can trust to take ownership over the situation. When you say, like, was it dumb of him to do that? I don't know. You know, it depends on what his goals are and who he is as a person. If he's looking to build generational wealth so that his grandkids, you know, never have to worry about where their next meal is coming from, then maybe it's not smart to leave money on the table. But then again, if Washington State is sort of a sinking ship and things are falling apart, and the only way for both Washington State to hold it together and for Tracy Clays to have an opportunity in the future is to sever that relationship so that they can both move forward, then maybe it's incredibly wise. I just love the way he went about it, and I love what he said. It was super refreshing, and I am not an optimist. I am not somebody who is without, like, extreme cynicism when it comes to especially coaches. I have a healthy ingrained distrust of authority, and this still spoke to me. I loved it.
Yeah, I loved it too. I loved the fact that he did take accountability, did the right. I mean, he did what he felt was right. So now, going back to UCLA, though, my question about Chip Kelly and UCLA, talking about the DC situation, the defensive coordinator. So it's Jerry Azzanaro. And I'm wondering, because Chip Kelly doesn't really have a history of firing guys. But at Oregon, he didn't need to because they were winning so many games and people were just leaving for new jobs. Everybody was, you know, when teams win, everybody gets hired. You're always replacing your staff. Yeah. Look at Alabama. Look at Clemson, except for their defensive coordinator. So you're always replacing people. But will Chip Kelly, Big Balls Chip Kelly, be willing to fire his friends? Because so many of the people in his staff, including Azzanaro, you have Don Pelham. You have other guys who were on his staff at Oregon or have coached with him other places. The defense looks atrocious. Will he be willing to fire his friends to get a new defensive coordinator and a new scheme?
Yeah, I mean, Jeffrey Lurie of the Eagles is forever regretted the fact that he gave full personnel control to Chip Kelly. You know, control has always been a thing with Chip Kelly. I mean, there's a book about him called Controlled Chaos, and control is right there in the name. You know, I think that it's going to be tough for Chip Kelly to find people that he trusts. One time, and Todd Graham got killed for this for the rest of his coaching career at Arizona State by other people in the coaching community. But I think that in his transition from Pitt to Arizona State, he called assistant coaches mercenaries. And to some extent, that's kind of what they are. Because you're, but so yeah. is everybody, right? In a capitalist society, you can't necessarily focus on those things. But, you know, control is really important for a guy like Chip Kelly. There's not a lot of people that maybe he feels like he can trust. And that's tough at the collegiate level when everybody's sort of using it as a platform to move on to the next thing. You know, you're talking about, oh, go ahead.
So could you, Ralph, fire your friend? Is the question. Could you fire somebody that you know that you've known for a long time because they're not getting their job done at coaching? If you were the head coach, could you fire your friend?
Yes, I could do it. And here's what, and I married a very smart and capable woman who is both a very artistic person as well as like a business executive. And one of the things that I've noticed in following her career is she's sort of moved up the ranks is she does something that not a lot of other people do. She fires people. And you know, nobody really likes to be like that person. Nobody likes that person. Nobody likes to be that person. The executioner, right? Everybody's afraid of the executioner. And the executioner always has a hood on because the executioner doesn't want people to know who he is either, right? But one thing that that my wife told me and has taught me over the last few years, I'm going to sound super whipped by saying this, but I don't care. I don't have anybody impressed. She has taught me that if you truly love the people around you, you will put them in positions to succeed, especially if they have not put themselves in a position to succeed. And so the thing that she always says is nobody that you fire should ever be surprised by it. Never. The expectation should always be laid out there, and you should always be tracking whether there's a gap between the expectations and the reality. And so nobody that you fire, unless it's for some like egregious thing that pops up out of nowhere that was deceitful or disruptive, nobody should ever be surprised by it.
Yeah, but they still know that they were going
to
get fired.
Yes, yeah, right. Yeah, you would still have to know. That shouldn't be a surprise to them. But anybody that she's coaching or she's in charge of or she's let go, it's been a thing where it said like, all right, well, these are the expectations. The company sets them. And so if you don't meet these expectations, then this is the consequence. How can I help you either A, meet these expectations, or B, transition to somewhere where you can meet their expectations? And it sounds cold-blooded, but I've watched over the years of like people that she's fired that have been pissed in the moment, like write her a thank you letter 3-4 years down the road saying like, I wasn't happy. You noticed, you tried to let me know. And now I'm in this position and I'm doing better. Like I'm doing better for myself. And so I don't think that I would have been able to do something like that because you want to be liked. And in other situations, you just want like a Baghdad Bob around you, right? You're either a control freak or you want to be popular. Either way, it's tough to let people go. And I think for Chip Kelly, he's not the kind of guy that would just use Jerry Azzanaro as a sacrificial lamb. And also, I think he'd be afraid about what's on the other side of that if he did. And I think another thing that I'm curious in you bringing up is that maybe Jerry Azzanaro's middle name is Attrick. I'll let you figure that one out on your own, but I think that'll bring you to your next point.
So I hope he is ready to make some serious moves. Wait, hold up. Tell me, what does Attrick mean? Oh, yes. So
geriatric.
That's funny. So that is the next point about UCLA's coaching staff. Their staff is really old. I mean, I hate to, it's the truth. They have an old coaching staff, and this is a young man's game. Recruiting is done via social media now. It's not just phone calls, text messages. It is done on social media with edits and with direct messages. You know, all of that. You have to be popping on social media for kids to really, really connect with you and your program. And UCLA staff is old. They are not of the Twitter generation. They are face planers, face tube watchers. They're not sure. I mean, even though they know how to use it, they're not actual, like, they're not in the in crowd in that. So if you are a coach now, I think that you have to pay attention to keeping young people on the staff. Look at Oregon's recruiting. Look at Washington's recruiting. They have young coaches on their staff, 30s, early 40s, like people who actually play with these devices and would be on social media regardless of being coaches and trying to recruit. They would be on there talking to their friends, sending viral stuff, sending, you know, memes, all of that. And UCLA's coaches are not. Like, I think that that plays a big part in why they are having trouble. Do you agree, Ralph?
Maybe. I mean, I don't like to be like just blatantly ageist, but there are that you do wonder, you know, Jerry Azzanaro graduated from American International College 3 years before that whole Apple commercial where you threw them the PC through the window or whatever. Like it doesn't necessarily need to be a young man's game from a coaching perspective, but you have to have the type of personality and persona that can understand and vibe with the modern game. You know, I think Herm Edwards is 64. They just brought Marvin Lewis on staff. You know, there are older guys, Charlie Fisher, Rob Likens, they got gray hair. But Arizona State staff kind of tends to be younger and more energetic and more open and understand, you know, remember when Jim Mora kind of bashed Josh Rosen for saying the like, Josh Rosen is a millennial. He just needs to know why, you know, for the coaches that are teachers, because that's what a freaking coach is you are a teacher. Your whole job has always been to treat your players like millennials. You don't just show them what to do. You tell them why they're doing it. That's the whole point of being a coach. Like, millennials should, and it sucks that more millennials aren't playing sports, because you would naturally transition into it because it is an immediate gratification type thing. You do the right thing. You see the right results, which trains your mind to want to do the right thing. And you get sort of that instant rush from like, oh, I was taught a thing, I did it well, I got a pat on the back for it, and you move on to the next thing. Like, sports this is the golden age of you know, millennials and sports should be intertwined, and they're not really, because, you know, for whatever reason. But like, coaching and teaching have always gone hand in hand, and unless you're a do as I say, not as I do, or, you know, sit at the kids' table and be seen and not heard type coach, then your age should never be a problem, because your job has always been to understand who you're trying to teach and how they learn, and then finding a way to get that done. So age shouldn't be an issue in coaching. We see what Pete Carroll does. We see what Herm Edwards has been doing. And as long as you understand that things change and it's your job to figure out how to teach people regardless of how things are changing, you should be fine. When we look at Chip Kelly, it is sort of more of a my way or the highway type situation. So I don't know. I don't know. Can age contribute to a lack of success when your responsibilities are just relating to kids in general? Yeah, I mean, especially when your recruiting philosophy is meet all of our standards before we'll welcome you
into
the family, when a lot of these kids just want to be courted. Like, they want to be convinced. And so I think more of the issue would just have to be, and Chip Kelly's a military guy, right? Like, he's got a military background. I think that a lot of it would just be more how stringent and closed off he is.
Because
I think
really,
he also only closes recruits, from what I've heard. Like, he doesn't participate in the recruiting process. He just comes in to say, like, welcome to UCLA once they are ready to go ahead and make that commitment. So if you're going to be that way, then you need to be surrounded by people who are sort of the
pretty
honey
much
trap
all
for all the
freshmen and redshirt freshmen.
Yeah.
That's the core of their team, and some sophomores who he recruited. Like, the juniors and seniors that were on this team are either not there anymore or they're on the bench for the most part. So
he came in, he cut two kids that I know, like, immediately, two offensive linemen from Saguaro High School down here. And, you know, both of those guys were pretty banged up and they were happy to take their scholarship and stay at UCLA. But he came in with the mindset that we're just going to cull the fat right away. And I think he maybe did a little bit too much of that. And that's also not a thing that I like to see, because just because they're not your guys, if you go in and you kick a bunch of people off the team because they're not your guys, you are admitting there is a deficiency in your ability to teach.
See, I don't agree with that, only because some players don't fit your style and some players don't fit your system. And that's just what it is.
But sometimes you're going to need those bodies. And if you can't win somebody over, how are you going to win games?
Yeah.
Especially in college football. And so if you come in paranoid that, like, oh, these are Mora's guys, you know, the reason that I was hired in the first place is because the culture was bad here. But if you believe that the fish rots from the head, and if you're going to be like Tracy Clays and say, like, oh, the person in charge is the one that's responsible for this, then you take some responsibility and you try to inject some new culture into the players that you have on board. I didn't like it when Herm Edwards came in and did it at Arizona State either, you know, and got rid of a bunch of guys. I wasn't a huge fan of that. But at least they came in with the mindset of, like, hey, we're going to be open and honest with you, and we're going to tell you whether or not you have a future here. I felt like UCLA did it more of a, like, hey, I'm here. This is the way it is now. I'm not going to give you the opportunity to, you know, to say that you want to be a part of this or not. I'm just going to move my stuff into the living room, and eventually I expect your stuff to be out by the morning.
Dude.
And I just don't know if that set a really good precedent when you can only have 85 scholarships and injuries are a thing, especially when you're playing young guys, they're going to get injured. I just feel like, you know, depth is, among everything else, talent and all that, depth is a huge issue for UCLA.
100%. And I guess we'll start with that game today. Oregon State 48, UCLA 31. This literally changed the bottom of the Pac-12 power rankings. Oregon State has been at the bottom for, I mean, this is only their second conference win in 3 years. Only the second conference win. So they've been at the bottom. Like, it's been clear. It's been evident. There's been no doubt. And now there's a new team at the bottom. Ralph, when I got to this game yesterday, I pulled up. So if anybody's been to the Rose Bowl, you generally have to park a decent amount of ways from the a decent walk away from the stadium. We pulled up into the parking lot because we came for my son's game at kickoff, basically. When we got to our seats, there was 6 minutes gone in the first quarter. So there was 9 minutes to go in the first quarter. Do you know what the score was, Ralph? Literally with 8:59 in the first quarter to go in the first quarter. Yes,
so they have 21 by that point yet.
21-0. That is probably I walked into the stadium, but as I was walking through the tunnel, I was checking the score in the Oregon game because I was watching it on my phone, but I was carrying the baby, so I had to put it down for a second. I couldn't watch it. And when I looked at my phone, the score flashed on the bottom. I was like, hell no, there's zero chance it's 21. The game just started. Yeah. And mind you, there were no turnovers in the process. None. And they were up 21-0. And I was just like, this is, but my initial thought was, okay, they got them right where they want them. Cause they went, they got 21-7. Then they gave up a score, 27-7, 27-10. And then it was 27-17. And I was like, uh-oh, here comes the comeback. Yeah, right. Nope. They can't, this team can't stop a nosebleed. And Dorian Thompson-Robinson, he did not play. And now UCLA is 1-5, 1-2 in the conference, and Oregon State is 2-3 and 1-1 in the conference. Rob, I was looking at the stats. UCLA rushed for more yards, had more first downs. They're only through for a few yards less. They're, you know, if you just looked at the stats, you would not think that they should have lost this game. They won the time of put possession, even though that's not necessarily a determination between winning and losing. And they gave up 0 points off of turnovers. So I can't even make sense of this.
I don't know what to tell you, man. I've been waiting for somebody to go out and just run the ball at UCLA and use the run to set up the pass, because for some reason Washington State wanted to run their offense regardless of whether or not they had built a 30-some point lead, and it came back to bite them, you know. And Stanford did what they did, but you know, Arizona, you know, Arizona came in and they threw the ball 29 times in the first half. And so I've been waiting for a team to just go out and treat UCLA like what they are, which is just a rusty turnstile on defense. And Oregon State did that. And then they were, and Jake Luton was efficient and threw 5 touchdowns. And this was just, I mean, this was a bloodbath because it should have been. UCLA is not a good team right now. And Oregon State has 2 or 3 guys that are at an all Pac-12 level and could be playing for anybody. They got 2 running backs, a receiver, and an outside linebacker who are probably all amongst the top 30 players in the Pac-12. And so, you know, if you go out there and you just play to your strengths and you lean on that, and if they need speed, they've got Tyjon Lindsey. And if they need dependability, they've got Colby Taylor. And if they need a spark, they got the little Champ Flemings. And if you just need a first down, Isaiah Hodgins is your guy. So, you know, I'm.
Well, I think he was more than just a first down. He had 10 catches for 123 and 3 touchdowns.
Sometimes you need a first down on first down. And he's that guy.
And the crazy part was, you are 100% right about the rushing game, because Oregon State averaged 5 rushing yards per game. 5. And
per carry.
Five per carry. And think about it. Jamar Jefferson only touched the ball 5 times. So, like, this was all Artavius Pierce. Even Jake
Vladimir Putin.
Okay. Or door number 3. My wife always makes fun of me because some things, so I say things like Valium and all this stuff. And this is one of these things with his name that for some reason I'm having a little bit of trouble with, but whatever. That's almost like when we got the email.
Saying LaVisca Chenault instead of LaVisca.
Yeah. And also about me saying, calling Tyrone,
Ty Whittingham instead of Kyle Whittingham.
Yes. And the reason why, just so everybody is clear, is because when I think of Whittingham, I'm thinking of Tyrone Willingham, the coach from Stanford. Oh my gosh. All these names are screwing with my mind right now. So anyways, let's get back to the Oregon.
Just be like, man, I got a baby. I got a baby at home.
I got a baby. I barely slept. I was on radio at 5 in the morning.
I'm leaning on it too. I got 4 kids. They're on fall break right now. My wife's in Chicago. Like, the fact that I'm even making words, I'm proud of me. You don't need to be proud of me.
So, yeah. So, Oregon State is still not great, but UCLA's worse. And I thought that this year, after UCLA losing, you know, 6 or 7 games last year by 25 or more points, that their goal should be to stay close and try to sneak a couple out. And they almost snuck the Stanford game out, and they beat UCLA. So now they're going to, when Utah heads up to Corvallis next week, that is a trap game. But we can move on to the next game. The Arizona Amsden Wildcats versus the Colorado Buffaloes. And this game went kind of how we thought it was. We thought it would be a high-scoring game. But I guess we found out our Khalil Tate conspiracy theory was not true, because he came out, he played well, and I was just waiting on Ralph to just, I know he was just basking in his own glory, because he had Khalil Tate play pretty well, except for the very end of the game where he almost tried to give it away, and he had UCLA lose big. So I was like, he's just rolling around like a pig in slop right now.
I honestly, like, I don't like to gloat that much, and Khalil Tate did a couple of things in this game that were just mind-bogglingly stupid, and so I can't, you know, if I'm going to be on him, I got to be, you know, his toughest critic as well. But the truth of the matter is that, what did I that it was now Boulder Khalil Ratto,
yeah,
is what they have to change the name to, because this dude owns the Buffaloes. I'm not even going to rattle off the stats. Just know he's only thrown for over 400 yards once ever, and it was on Saturday. And before that, he had only gone over like 350 twice, one versus Hawaii in a comeback attempt at the beginning of this year, and the other time was against Colorado. And he got his start rushing for over 320 yards against Colorado. So they are done. They are done with him. They never have to face him again. So congratulations to Colorado. You're finally rid of him. He had a couple of bad mistakes in the game. He just gifted the Buffaloes a touchdown right before halftime. And then he came out and he threw a 75-yard touchdown on the very next play. So, I mean, you get what you get with him. He's probably not fully healthy, because, you know, he had a good run to start the game, and then he finished the game with a run, with an emphatic first down run, which was pretty cool. But this Colorado defense isn't that good. Had he done anything less than what he did yesterday, I think that there would have been reason to probably criticize his effort. This is what I believe he should be doing. He should be scaring defenses into giving him the ability to hit open receivers. So the Khalil Tate that showed up yesterday is the Khalil Tate that I expect to continue to show up. But this defense is what do the kids say? It's boo boo. It's very bad.
They say and it's trash. Oh man, he's trash. Trash.
This Arizona defense is not very good. It's not very deep. They've got injury issues. They could have some serious trouble down the line. So it kind of doesn't really matter to me the rest of the way what Khalil Tate does, because they're about to really like enter the danger zone as far as their schedule goes. And I think he's going to have some good statistical performances. But I honestly, George, I don't even know if he finishes the year at quarterback, because there is some, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, I think that you see it and everybody else who follows this program sees it too. I don't think this coaching staff likes him very much. I don't think that they want him at quarterback. After the game, the Pac-12 reporter was asked, you know, what about Khalil Tate, you know, when you made the decision for him to go, and Kevin Sumlin like instantly changed the subject, like immediately changed the subject to not have to talk about Khalil Tate. Then she went over to ask Khalil Tate, like, what made you decide that you were ready to play, because he was a game time decision. And he said, you're going to have to ask Coach Sumlin that question. And so, you know, and it all harkens back to me remembering the very, very first moment in my head of Kevin Sumlin coming to Arizona. He got like interviewed at an Arizona basketball game after being hired, and he called Khalil Tate Khalil Mack.
Are you serious?
And it was just from that point on, it was just like, man, this dude does not They have Khalil Tate there because they have to. I would not be surprised if they don't finish the season with him. It just, something seems off to me, man. Something seems seriously off. He should be the guy. They should be, you know, celebrating him. That relationship seems icy. The way they ran the offense when he wasn't on the field was just, it was a completely different animal. Everything to me seems like they just can't wait to move on from him. And if they hit a rough patch, if they lose a couple of games, I don't think it's going to matter what he does statistically. I think eventually you're going to see Arizona maybe make that transition into who it is they're going to be instead of sticking with who they are right now. And this is a weird prediction for me to make because I am not into conspiracy theories or gossip or, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. There's no inside information here. It's just the vibe I'm picking up is that this is not going to work out well for Arizona down the stretch. Feels weird to say that about a 4-1 team coming off a good win where Khalil Tate just threw for 400 yards. But I'm telling you, something is wrong. Well,
they got to go to Seattle. They have to go to Seattle next week to play Washington. Then they go at USC, at Stanford, Oregon State, then Oregon, and then Utah and Arizona State. You are right. That is a murderer's row at that point. Like you don't get a week off. You don't get time to just, you know, collect yourself. And there is a chance that they could drop three in a row or three or four. And yeah, and you could be absolutely right about that. But I wanted to talk about Colorado for a second. They're doing all this without Chenault. I'm not even going to try to say his first name right now because this is just I have to realize my limitations with fatigue and with everything else I got going on. I have to realize, so I'm not even going to make anybody upset today. So, but Colorado, though, I love the direction that they are headed. This team feels like they are competing hard. They dropped another close game that they could have won to Arizona. And it just, so they lost 35-30. And the previous week they lost by 3 to Arizona State. Oh, no, I'm sorry. They beat Arizona State. And then but the week before that, they lost to Air Force 30-23. And the resounding theme with this team is defense. They gave up 31 to Colorado State, 31 to Nebraska, 30 to Air Force, 31 to Arizona State, and 35 to Arizona. I mean, this is who do you think at this point, besides UCLA, has the worst defense in the Pac-12?
You got to flip a coin between Oregon State and Colorado, I think. And maybe Washington State's up there because you had the resignation or whatever, and obviously they gave up a million points to UCLA. But I don't have any faith in this Colorado defense. They got a couple of good players, but yeah. Mustafa not being out there, you know, Landman is a linebacker. He's not going to be able to cover deep routes. They don't get a ton of pressure on the quarterback unless it's like an obvious pin your ears back and rush the quarterback 3rd and 10 situation like they did at the end of the game against ASU. There are issues. I don't know if they're talent or schematic. I guess maybe time will tell. It feels like they've got some good players out there, but I'm not really sure. They've played against some talented offenses as well, and then you got the gimmicky Air Force stuff going on. So maybe we'll see if they kind of figure things out down the line or if it continues to be their Achilles heel. What I want to talk about with Colorado is, when did Steven Montez and Tony Brown become Andrew Walter and Derek Hagan?
Bro, dude, Tony Brown, remember at the beginning of the season, I told you that somebody, they sent me a tweet when I was talking about that USC had the best wide receivers in the country. Then it was like Alabama, Clemson, and Oklahoma. And somebody said, you're forgetting about Colorado. They have these guys, even Tony Brown. And just like, okay, yeah. But
yeah, that had to be Tony Brown's mom or something. Like, there's no way you could have expected him in his fifth year to go off like this. I tweeted yesterday, like, Arizona and Arizona State fans have to be united in their hatred of Tony Brown right now. And I got a bunch of tweets that like, we'll never be united about anything. And I was like, all right. But like, he's had a full-on career against both teams. He looks It doesn't look like a couple of good games either. To the naked eye, he looks like an elite football player.
Yep.
And maybe it's just the connection that they have. Maybe it's LaVisca not being out there. But my goodness, is this kid balling out right now. And maybe it takes 5 years for somebody. But, I mean, he looks like he could get himself, after 4 years of being a guy who gets maybe, you know, 20 reps a game, whether at Texas Tech or now at Colorado, this dude looks like he's going to get his name called.
Yes. Yes, he looks like an NFL wide receiver. And coming into the game, he was already seventh in the conference in yards per game. And you know he's a little bit higher on that after this week because some of the guys in front of him either didn't play or didn't play or didn't put up big stats at all. So he's going to be creeping up to the top of that list. And I'm just saying, like, this is pretty impressive. So I want to give him a lot of credit for it. But with Colorado in general, Mel Tucker has his team competing. They're playing hard, and he's a defensive coach. So you know at some point in time that this offseason, particularly in recruiting, that it is going to be paramount for them to get the horses and put in a scheme because he's got to learn how to play against Pac-12 competition. And he's got to figure out how to win on defense. And I think he's going to be a guy who can get it done and make it very, very tough.
And then, I mean, and Steve Montez has given him absolutely everything he has right now, like, especially with the way the season ended last year of Montez losing 7 in a row, you know, and maybe it'll end up looking this year a lot like it did last year because – I think last year he started out in the first 5 games. He had 11 touchdowns, 2 interceptions. He's at 10-2 right now. Yeah, and then to finish the season, he threw 8 touchdowns, 7 interceptions, including 3 at the end of the season at Cal. And he looked terrible. So maybe he sort of regresses, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen. It just watching the way that he's playing and watching the way that offense is running, he looks like he's grown up. He's got a good connection with his guys, and they're doing it without LaVisca Chenault. And so I think that gives LaVisca time to heal up to make sure that when he comes back, that he's truly ready to go and not out there with a core injury, you know, aggravating anything.
Yeah, this Colorado team has a little bit of a schedule ahead of them as well. They got Oregon next week, which looks like an impossible task, unless they turn the ball over, unless they turn the ball over the same way they did against Cal in the beginning of the game. Then they go at the Palouse, so they play Washington State, USC. Then they get a game against UCLA that might be 72-68. And then they got Stanford, Washington, and at Utah to finish the season.
It is not.
That's not exactly an easy schedule. So we will see how this team goes. And if they continue to compete, that's what I want to see the most. And then we'll get to the last 2 games of the day. So the next game in order of time was the Cal went up to Oregon. Cal went up to Oregon, lost 17-7. But Cal was up in the game. They were winning the football game until the third quarter. So Oregon went up. Oregon kicked a field goal with 7 minutes to go in the third quarter. That was their first points. Even though they had already missed a field goal earlier, it was 7-3 with 7 minutes left. And it did not appear that Cal was going to be able to score. Oregon actually gave up their first touchdown since week 1 against Auburn, which is pretty incredible. They hadn't given up a touchdown in 3 games. And they gave up 1 in the first quarter against Cal. And then they scored again with 1:38 left to go in the third quarter. And at 10-7, it was pretty much over. They added another touchdown late. But I would say the story of this game was Cal's defense, dude. Without their quarterback, without anything, they managed to hold the – I mean, well, they forced Oregon into three turnovers. Two of them were pretty self-inflicted, but it was still pretty amazing to see how hard these kids compete.
Yeah. I mean, I was telling you before we started recording, Cal looked good. Cal looked like a really good football team. They just weren't the best team. I mean, there was a talent deficiency there. Maybe that will close over time. But at the that's why you play four quarters. This is something that Colin Cowherd always says, that like there's a reason that the game is four quarters, and it's that, and it's toward the end when you will see those who are truly talented start to pull away. And that's all that really happened. This was a great effort from Cal. I didn't even think that, you know, that things really looked that bad from a quarterback perspective. It could certainly be worse based on what our expectations were going into the game. Couple of costly injuries for Oregon. Absolutely hated to see that toward the end, but this is what happens.
Oh, with that, yeah, that Gus yeah. Cumberlander, he got hurt. That was really bad. And it looks like he's probably going to be out for the rest of the season, probably, or at least till bowl game.
And so, you know, I hate to see stuff like that, but that's what comes with some of these knockdown, drag out, you know, or drag out, knockdown, or however you say it, matchups. I watched a good portion of this game, and the stat that they flashed across the screen that really shocked me was this is the first time Oregon's been shut out in the first half at Autzen Stadium since Indiana came there in 2004. So, I mean, Cal did something really, really special, and I really liked that after the game, Justin Wilcox said that, like, we can't hang our heads after this. And I agree with him. I think that this was a good step forward for them, and probably a lesson to Mike Leach.
They're just
hey, you know, we played hard and we lost. You know, there are no moral victories, but there are things that we can build off of. You know, he didn't come out there and rip his players, at least publicly. You know, I'm sure he had some stuff to say in film.
There was nothing to rip them. There was nothing to rip them about. Like they were just outmatched. And that leads me to this. Cal is a very unique situation. They have Justin Wilcox, who's their head coach. He is obviously a phenomenal head coach. He's hired, you know, really a Tim DeRuiter, really good defensive coordinator. Obviously, I mean, like, they're doing a really good job of coaching guys up. His assistant coaches are really good, particularly on defense. But the question I continuously ask myself is this, Ralph. Is this a team? Is this a university that can get five-star talent or a bunch of four-star talent? Because they've been able to develop guys into NFL prospects that were two- and three-star players. So can they get elite talent there? And if not, how long before Justin Wilcox gets an opportunity at UCLA or gets an opportunity at Florida State or anywhere else?
Yeah, I mean, I hate that we're even talking about that, but there are issues at Cal. Obviously, the support for the football program isn't as high as it is in some other places. And, you know, they could use definitely an infusion of capital to help keep up with the Joneses. They've been doing some positive things, and I think they're moving in the right direction by just even having Wilcox there. I'm more worried about his staff cashing in on the goodwill that they've built up than I am necessarily. You know, you got a guy like Charlie Ragle out there who has helped just plunder Arizona of talent. And, you know, this is a guy that wants to be a head coach someday. You know, what happens if he gets an opportunity? You know, I think he's from New Mexico, and New Mexico State's like the worst team on the planet. You know, does he look at that as an opportunity? There's a bunch of guys on their defensive backs coach. I mean, they have so many good coaches out there that are all doing a really good job. How do you get them to keep reinvesting in this program and see it through when everybody's also got their individual goals and you want them to accomplish those as well? It's going to be an interesting balancing act, but I think that if they can find a way to get some athletes at the receiver position and at the running back position, and maybe even just harken back to the days of having six straight running backs at Cal that were all picked in the NFL draft, you know, whether it was, you know, J.J. Arrington or Marshawn, you know, they're not all going to be super special, but
Travis
exactly,
Best.
Exactly. I think that they need a guy, right? They need a guy on the offensive side of the football who is going to be the balance to like an Evan Weaver type on the defensive side of the football, somebody that you can really rely on, because right now they're just piecing together these drives and don't really have that super threat or playmaker. That receiver that they have, the JUCO kid, the 6'5 kid, he could be really good, but you don't have anybody to really consistently get him the ball now.
Oh, they got Garber. Stop hating but they don't on have Garbers. Him. He's a good quarterback, Ralph. Oh, wet blanket, man. He'll be back. Maybe. But on the Oregon side, though, I was very encouraged. I have been asking for Oregon to run the football better. And finally, they ran the football better. You saw gashes. You saw 18, 19, 16, 20. Like, this was what you want to see out of an Oregon football team. I mean, even C.J. Verdell, who I've been critical of, had some good runs. His long was only 11, but he looked like he had some vision. And Cal is no slouch on defense. So, I want to give them credit for that. The other thing is they didn't have necessarily conservative play. And the other thing was Micah Pittman looks really, really good. This was his first game playing. They got Brendan Schooler back, who's more of a possession receiver, but he looked a little faster this week. They got Juwan Johnson, the Penn State transfer, back on the field. And this wide receiving core is at full strength for the first time. I think that they are going to really, really have a chance. If they stay focused, this is a team that will be in the top 10 in a couple weeks.
Do you think, and maybe this sounds crazy, but I kind of felt this way watching the game, that the infusion of talent at wide receiver sort of threw off the balance of some stuff? Like, maybe people were playing positions that they hadn't played up until yes. that point. It just felt like the rhythm was just off. Especially with like Breland, he'd make a couple of catches and then he just wouldn't be in the right place, or Herbert wouldn't be able to find him. Johnny Johnson just looked absolutely pedestrian. And you hate to see that up and down with him, but that's just what was going on.
Well, that's who he's kind of been though, too.
Yes. Yeah. But the just lack of consistent, I think, you know, I think long-term it's a good thing, but maybe you have some guys playing out of position or switching, that just affected the chemistry for a one game only type thing, because I didn't, you know, I just thought that they looked like they were all, it looked like the first game of the year. Yeah. As far as the passing game,
I would, that was a great summation of it. And the last game in the Pac-12 this week was a shocker for most, but not so much for me. Stanford, who had looked terrible at times this year. I mean, absolutely putrid when they lost to UCF. They were horrible in the first half. They were better in the second half. They put up a fight against Oregon, so that 21-6 loss against Oregon actually looked a little bit better. But then they came up and gave up 28 points to Oregon State at Oregon State. And then they come back and beat Washington. And when I was looking at this game, Ralph, I was like, David Shaw's a good coach. Like, he's a good coach. He's going to figure something out. Even though I've said he's a late adopter offensively, he figured something out. Like he just exploited the things that Washington does not do well. The truth is, Washington has some receivers. They do not like to be touched and do not like to be hit. They dropped balls in the Cal game. They dropped balls in the Stanford game. You put a little wood on them, and they don't like catching those intermediate passes across the middle where you can get touched up even a little bit with the new rules. And that's what happened. They dropped a bunch of that, and they just got whipped up front by Stanford. And Stanford lost another defensive lineman, so they're out without Walker Little. They lost another defensive lineman. I don't know what to make of this Washington team right now. But I will say, Ralph, I'm not afraid to say, I was right, and I told you about Jacob Eason.
Yeah, I mean, I see where you're going. I don't know if I'm willing to meet you there yet. Some of this felt like Eason's fault, and some of it felt like, I don't know. George, how many movies have you seen where someone like walks into quicksand and they start to sink, and then like one person there is like, oh, you're not supposed to move. Stop moving. And then, you know, I always thought growing up, like, man, if I ever see quicksand, I'm totally going to know what to do. But yeah. It turns out quicksand is like way more prevalent in kids' shows. And it was just in the Dora the Explorer movie. Don't go see that. My kids talked me into that. That was not a positive experience. But they had quicksand in that movie too. And I'm like, oh, you just don't move and you'll be fine. But yet there's always somebody who isn't aware and they kick and scream and they get swallowed up, right? I'm watching this game and I just, every single thing Washington did, it was like, stop moving, stop. Like, you're doing the exact thing. Like, Stanford is just quicksand. It's obsolete if you, and it's not a problem if you just don't play into what they want you to play into. And I felt like Washington just slowly killed themselves all night long. They didn't run the ball. They didn't even put their tight ends on the field. Cade Otton and Hunter Bryant had 3 combined catches. Those guys are supposed to be lethal weapons for Washington. I mean, you might want to talk about the receivers being soft, but like, these tight ends, they can play. Yep. Hunter Bryant wasn't even on the field for like a huge part of the second half. Ahmed touched the ball like, what, 7 times?
Yeah.
And he's your star? They ran the ball 19 times in what was effectively a 1-score game for a lot of the game.
Well, they didn't really have a lot of plays, though, either.
Because no, Stanford, they did not.
Stanford had the ball. Washington only had the ball out of a 60-minute game. They had the ball for 20 minutes. Stanford had the ball for 40 minutes. They just got – and they got 24 first downs to Washington's 15. Stanford rushed
– but what do you – what are you doing throwing the ball 2-1? I don't get it. Like, what, they go out there and throw the ball on first down? That's what they want you to do.
Yeah, but you got like this fancy new toy from Georgia,
yeah,
that everybody screamed right about was going to be the Pac-12 player of the year, the best player in the conference. He's going to be revolutionary, and he came out here and he's had this relatively pedestrian game, 16 for 36, which is below 50%. One touchdown, 1 interception, I think. Yeah. And it was very pedestrian. He had a pedestrian game against Cal. And even last week, I think as well, like he hasn't been special at all. I mean, he was special against the bad teams, but Jacob Eason is an upgraded, he is, if Jake Browning was iOS 12.8, Jacob Eason is 13.1. This is not a huge difference. It is just an update to
your. But that should be good enough. That should be good enough, especially if we've learned anything in football over the last 10 years by watching Aaron Rodgers, one of the most talented dudes to ever do it, and Tom Brady, an incredibly good quarterback. If we've learned anything from just the 2 careers of those side by side, it's that your quarterback can't do it alone and that you shouldn't have to depend on him to make big plays if you want to win. So it doesn't matter how talented Jacob Eason is. If you go out there with 2 hands tied behind your back, you're not going to be able to throw punches or defend yourself. And they didn't use their tight ends and they didn't really run the ball. And they got embarrassed by a Stanford team who lost Henry Haddis to, I hope to God he's okay, because that looked disgusting. You mentioned they don't have Walker Little. There's 3 freshmen starting on that Stanford offensive line. They were on their 3rd string quarterback, and I know how you feel about Cameron Scarlett, and they still went out there and punched Washington in the mouth. and made them look stupid. These types of games should not be happening in 2019, the year of our Lord. We talked about this. Stanford is outdated. They are going the way of the Buffalo. As long as you don't fall into these little situations in which Stanford ultimately has the advantage because you decided to play their game, then you Stanford should be fine.
The second worst rush offense in the entire Pac-12, going against one of the best rushing defenses in the Pac-12, and they just ran them over. And let me give you guys some insight if you do not know. So the problem with Washington is this. Their defensive coordinator, who is a good defensive coordinator, he's a smart guy, Jimmy Lake. He is the defensive backs coach, and the majority of time, as you saw Stanford, they rarely got into a lot of tight end sets. They mainly stayed in one back out of the shotgun, or even if they were under center, they didn't get in a lot of those heavy sets that they normally get in. So what they did is Washington likes to play with five defensive backs on the field. Sometimes they even play with six. And so the majority of the time they're in a 4-2-5. So four down linemen, two linebackers, and five defensive backs. And Stanford was playing smart because one of the other guys that's on the field for them is Cody Parkinson, who's a huge tight end, 6'7". They played big guys versus little guy football. And the big guys won because big guys knocked little guys out of the way. And they didn't make an adjustment to put a third linebacker on the field and take another defensive back off the field. So whenever they put three linebackers out there, Stanford threw the ball. Whenever they put two out there, they ran the ball. It was they got out-coached. David Shaw figured out what was going on with Washington and out-coached them.
Definitely. Definitely a coaching win and a coaching loss. And Stanford did it with spare parts. And I'm not super confident in how things are going to go for Stanford the rest of the year based on some of the things that are happening. But at least we figured a few things out. Davis Mills was the number one. He might not, when it's all said and done, he might be far from having been the number one rated pocket passer in his entire class. But he was rated that way for a reason. He is more than capable. We learned that. We also learned that if you give them an opportunity, they will still find a way to win. And so Stanford is still dangerous in this conference. Washington, this is two losses now that maybe didn't need to be. And
yeah. Yeah, and Washington fans were I go into everybody's message boards and all of that, and the Washington fans were saying, we're fine. Same thing happened last year. We lost to Cal. Gold is on the Rose Bowl. Don't worry. Don't panic. And you lose to Stanford now, and you're like, we are 0-2.
No, these are two Pac-12 North losses. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. It is time to
be. You're in trouble.
Yeah. The chances of going to the Rose Bowl are slim now because you have to go beat Oregon, which has at least, they have a better defense than Stanford, and their defense production wise is better than Cal's. Even though I do think that Cal's overall defense may be a little bit better, but Oregon is only in their last four games, they've only given up one touchdown, and they haven't even allowed a team to score more than 7 points. So I'm like,
George, even if Washington goes 5-1, which they are more than capable of going 5-1 the rest of the way, it will still end up being three losses in your division, not just in the conference, in your division. And that's not a place that they want to be ever. That's a tough year. They go 9-3 and consider it a tough year.
Yeah, especially when those losses aren't like non-conference losses against like a huge team. None of them are that. You just lost your conference games. That means you are a middle-of-the-road team in the conference this year, not overall, but this year. When Washington fans, they were talking potential national championship. And it's just not happening. So the question is, what does the future at quarterback look like for Washington? But anyways.
Because I got a couple of tweets from people yesterday saying that these next six games go well and Jacob Eason bounces.
I mean, in theory he could, but I doubt that he – I think that if he leaves, based upon what he's shown so far, he will be drafted somewhere around the time that Jason Stidham was out of Auburn. When everybody thought that Jason Stidham, oh, he's going to be a first-round draft pick. Yeah, nah, he's probably fifth or sixth-round pick. That's kind of where Jacob Eason is.
Yeah, right. You know what sucks about that is Stidham is probably going to end up the best quarterback from that draft class because he ended up in the perfect situation at the perfect twilight of Tom Brady's career. So I don't want to say too many bad things about him because I'm sick of the Patriots winning and I don't want another 15 years
of
this.
Yeah, you.
But can I just want to say one thing before we move on to the Washington-Stanford game that I absolutely love. And I'm not kidding you. I'm not exaggerating that I was falling asleep. And part of the reason was the commentators, it was just over for them. This was like, what, a three-point game at halftime? And the entire second half, it was like the crew that was working the game was like, this is it. Like, I remember when Washington punted midway through the fourth quarter, they were like, well, they're probably not getting the ball back.
It was Jason Benetti, Rod Gilmore, and Quint Kisenich. And they were all saying, oh, well, you know, if Washington punts, I understand why they're punting on 4th and 19, but, you know, they may not get the ball.
But that's that, yeah. It's like watching somebody, you watch somebody put somebody else in a full Nelson. And it's like that. Maybe that first that person's first time ever being in a full Nelson. So they're struggling, and you're just sitting there telling them like, "Hey, just give up because you're done. Like, it's over. Just relax because the more you struggle, the worse it's gonna be." That's what it felt like watching the end of this game. With the crew was just like,
Well, thank you guys for joining us for the Pac-12 Apostles. We appreciate your time, appreciate your energy. Thank you so much. You guys make sure you share the feed, download the feed, tell a friend about the Unafraid Show, and tell a friend about the Pac-12 Apostles podcast. We will try to get more sleep before the next podcast. Peace out. Catch you guys later.